Finding basic legal services such as drafting a contract or selling a house is becoming more difficult in some rural Iowa communities. Attorneys in these communities are retiring, and many are not being replaced. River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Later this hour, we'll talk about a new collaboration between the Iowa State Bar Association and Iowa law programs to encourage young attorneys to practice in small towns. Before that, University of Iowa President Sally Mason will join us as part of our regular summer series of conversations with Iowa University and college presidents. We'll ask about her upcoming trip to Asia and campus recovery 4 years after the devastating flood of 08. It all starts right after this news. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, and today in our first half hour, as part of our regular summer series of conversations with Iowa University and college presidents, we have the good fortune of having in our studio today University of Iowa President Sally Mason. Good afternoon to you. Welcome back.
Thank you, Ben. Good to be here.
I want to talk about a number of things, so we'll get right to it. And we want to invite our listeners, if you have a question for President Mason, please join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org is our email. Iowa Public Radio is also on Facebook, or you can tweet us at IPR Talk. President Mason, in a few days, you and a number of other University of Iowa officials will be traveling to Asia for several days, visiting Hong Kong, I see, Shanghai, Beijing in China, also Taipei in Taiwan. What are your specific goals on that trip?
Well, we have a number of goals on that trip, and certainly one of the big ones is to connect with a number of our alumni, donors, people who have been important to the university over the years, as well as young people who are both attending the university now and planning to think about attending the university. The first thing we're going to do in Hong Kong is to graduate a class of our MBA students from the MBA program in Hong Kong, and I'll be joined in that activity by our provost, Barry Butler, and our new dean, Sarah Gardial.
I was interested to see that China is home to the largest international population here at the University of Iowa. More than 17,000 University of Iowa students hailing from China, a significant number of Asian alumni.
Correct.
And Chinese alumni. Tell us, what is the importance of reaching out to these alumni in China who were here X number of years ago and presumably had a great experience?
And for the most part, that's what we hear. They love their experience here. They've been great ambassadors for us. They are always, the reason the numbers continue to grow is because many of these alumni go back to their home country and their city they live in, and they tell their friends and neighbors that Iowa is a great place to be. And not surprisingly, we have even more students than wanting to come to the University of Iowa from these places. And I think it's a great opportunity for us in Iowa City, obviously, in terms of the diversity and the culture that they bring to Iowa City, but it's also an economic boost as well.
Mm-hmm. In what sense? In what specific ways?
Well, we know that international students across the state, not just at the University of Iowa, but all across the state, result in over $200 million a year in economic development, so to speak. In other words, money that they're spending, they and their families are spending. In Iowa City, we see the direct effects of that, obviously, from the students that we have enrolled here, many of whom come and stay for several years. Oftentimes, family members come to visit. Sometimes family members even come and stay with them while they're here as students. And that brings, again, more economic growth to the area.
I was reminded by my producer, I think I misspoke a moment ago, and I said 1,700 University of Iowa students from China.
Current students, yes.
Current
we
students
have many more alumni, and I thought that maybe was the number you were quoting.
No, I just got added one more zero than was accurate there. Do you expect the number of Chinese students to increase at the University of Iowa in coming years?
It has been steadily, not by large numbers, but it's certainly been steadily increasing over the last few years. And not surprising, as China continues to emerge as a major economy, major world economy, we see the effects of that, I think, all across the country.
Let's talk a little bit about flood recovery. That's been a topic of all of our previous conversations.
It does seem to be getting old, doesn't it?
Well, it's 4 years old this month,
it
as
is.
A matter of fact. We had that great flood of 08 in eastern Iowa 4 years ago, devastated Cedar Rapids. We've done a lot of reporting on that, but also a portion of the University of Iowa Parts of Iowa City flooded when the Iowa River left its banks 4 years ago. Multiple university buildings, including the Union, Hancher Auditorium, Foxman Music Building, the Clapp Recital Hall, the Art Museum, other art buildings damaged. The entire recovery process now, is this correct? Nearly $1 billion?
I'm afraid so. I think we now hold the distinction of being the largest single disaster that FEMA has ever had to deal with. It's obviously very large. We lost over 2 million square feet of space, usable space on our campus during the flood. Now, we've recovered a great deal of that as well. We were fortunate to be able to get the Mayflower Dormitory Residence Hall back up and running in time for the semester to start that fall. And if we hadn't done that, I'm not sure we could have opened. So we had a lot of things on our plate immediately when we got through that. Then we began the longer-term planning for the full recovery of the buildings as well as the destruction of the buildings that were totally demolished, really, by the floods and those that need to be replaced entirely. So we're now in the process of beautiful designs, I think, for the buildings that were destroyed in the flood. We're anxious to begin the groundbreaking for those buildings. We think we should be able to get started on those this year. I wouldn't be surprised if by the end of this summer we start to see some earth moving over on the west side of campus where New Hancher Auditorium is likely to be. And by the same token, I think later in the year we'll start to see Old Hancher come down slowly, gradually.
Now, it wasn't too long ago when we had that estimate of the cost, recovery cost, to more in the $700 or $800 million.
Correct.
Now we're talking significantly more. What can we attribute that to?
Well, as I've continued to say from the very beginning, when you're making estimates immediately after a disaster, you do the best you can. Mm-hmm. You really don't have a good idea of exactly what it's going to cost to either replace or in some cases rebuild entire buildings. And we didn't know at the beginning that we would be rebuilding or replacing three major building complexes. So that's part of the cost. Plus, as you begin to calculate the square footage that you're replacing and you look at the building costs today versus the building costs 4 years ago, you can see changes there too. It's never an exact science. And in fact, until we bid these projects out, we don't know exactly what they will cost. And we have yet to get those bids.
FEMA, as I understand it, has already awarded more than $200 million for this total recovery effort. But I understand that there's some disagreement still specifically over whether to fund the replacing of the art museum. The university could say, we don't need an art museum anymore. How important is that to you, that there is a viable art museum at the University of Iowa?
Well, we have one of the premier collections of art in the country. And we have many, many art students and art history students that have always used that collection. We have pieces in particular in African art and some other areas that only we have, and only we have that kind of expertise. I think the art museum not only is an important educational tool, but it's also important to the community.
So you wouldn't negotiate that away? You wouldn't say,
We
cannot afford it?
I would not, no. Mm. No.
So what is the holdup with FEMA? What is the disagreement about the art museum?
Well, you know, when you end up being the largest single disaster they've ever dealt with, I can only imagine the complications and the kinds of things that have to be done to justify each and every piece of this. They were reluctant, obviously, at the very beginning to look at that building and say that the building had been entirely destroyed. And in fact, the building still stands in the floodplain today and is usable. And I think therein lies the dilemma. The building is there and is usable, unfortunately, and by FEMA's rules, it says the building needs to be usable for the purpose for which it was originally intended. We have not been able to find an insurer that would insure the art collection were we to put it back in that building in that floodplain. Mm-hmm. So in essence, we cannot use that building for the purpose for which it was intended. And that's been the basis for our appeal and our arguments to FEMA all along. And we're going to continue to see if we can't push that argument a little further.
You said appeal. Are you pursuing legal action, or could you pursue legal action against FEMA?
Yeah, it's possible we could. I think we're going to exhaust all negotiation opportunities before we think seriously about litigation. Mm-hmm. And I don't think we've exhausted all of those yet, so we still have a few steps to take.
Do you have a deadline?
With FEMA, it's hard to set deadlines. They seem to work on their own time, and it's we don't necessarily always know when they will tell us their decisions. So we just have to work very diligently and strategically moving forward on these things.
Why not go forward with replacing the museum with other funds while you're waiting on FEMA?
Well, if we, it's possible we could get to that point. But at this point in time, I think we want to exhaust all possibilities, especially because we feel very strongly, given the nature of all of the other projects that they're funding for us, that this too is deserving of funding.
Is this, the art museum question, the biggest challenge you've faced in recovering from the 08 flood, or is there another one you haven't mentioned yet in this conversation?
I think every one of these major projects has been a major, major effort on the part of many, many good people at the university. We have a team of people that have been working literally every day since the flood 4 years ago on these projects, making certain that we don't miss anything, that we keep up to date, that we file every form that we need to, that we keep FEMA informed. It is a very tedious process, to say the least, but I have to give a great deal of credit to our team for persistence and for intelligence when it comes to working on these projects.
If you've just joined us, my guest in this first half hour of River to River is a live conversation with University of Iowa President Sally Mason. We like to, during the summer months, when we think we're not quite as busy, perhaps we are as busy. I imagine a university president is quite busy during the summer. We like to check in with all the university presidents in Iowa and college presidents. And we're doing so with Sally Mason today. If you'd like to join our conversation with a question, 1-866-780-9100. Email us rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. You can give us a tweet, if you'd like, at IPR Talk. Fundraising, a big part of what university presidents do these days, has been for many years, especially at public universities in times when there are declining state revenues for higher education. There have been a number of fundraising-related issues, controversies, I'll say, in the news I'd mm-hmm. like to ask you about. First of all, the University of Iowa Foundation has come under fire recently for its fundraising efforts. The foundation raises money for the University of Iowa. The University of Iowa Hospitals is giving patient names and specific patient treatment information to the UI Foundation, this fundraising organization, that is then used to solicit donations through written appeals signed by physicians. Now, a national advocacy group has called Public Citizen calls this practice of having doctors sign fundraising letters saying it takes advantage of the way people feel about doctors to help them. It says it's distasteful. So if I'm understanding this correctly, President Mason, I get a life-saving surgery at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. Then, some weeks or months later, comes a letter from a doctor who performed the surgery soliciting a contribution. Do you have any ethical concerns with this sort of campaign?
ethical concerns, certainly we look at these all the time. We think about them. They're serious issues, and we are constantly looking at best practices, attempting to understand exactly what is appropriate, what isn't appropriate. We feel we are using best practices mm-hmm. in this particular case. I'll give you a personal example of my own that I think encapsulates some of what's going on. I have a niece that I'm very, very fond of who lives back east, and a few years ago she had a baby. This baby was several months premature. And if it weren't for a NICU in a hospital back east that allowed this 2-pound baby to survive for over 2 months in the NICU, she wouldn't be alive today.
That's wonderful.
Not surprisingly, my niece was so grateful when she was asked whether or not she'd be willing to help do some fundraising for the NICU. She said yes. And who did she contact? But myself, my husband, and all of the other family members. And we all contributed. Now, I get letters every month from this organization. I don't mind it. I don't always say I'm going to give money. I think that is something that's very personal. And I also know it doesn't matter to the physician, to the doctor, or anyone who's signing these letters, whether I do or don't. But it does warm my heart to see the physician signing the letter. Now, maybe I just feel different about it than some
people. Okay, so you don't feel a line has been crossed here. But
I don't, yeah. But I can see where some might.
Where is the line then for you?
Well, for
what about a personal visit from a surgeon who performed surgery for soliciting a donation?
Having also been in the position many, many years ago to have my life saved by two surgeons, I was delighted when they came to visit me. Absolutely delighted.
And asked for a donation?
In neither case did they ask for a donation. But we had conversations, and I felt I was very young then. I had no money. They could have asked for a donation, and they wouldn't have been able to get very much from me.
Okay.
But today, I feel very strongly about both of them. They're both still alive in Indiana, where I happened to have been had my life saved at that time. And when I lived in Indiana 6 or 7 years ago, I did make some donations at that point in time to the very things that they were doing. So it pays off later, too.
Let's talk a little bit about the University of Iowa Foundation's overhead, which has also been in the news. If
sure.
you want to donate money to the University of Iowa, your gift goes through a tax-exempt foundation. We just discussed it. We
Correct.
Just named it the University
mm-hmm.
of Iowa Foundation. Recent disclosures of practices have given some people some pause. The foundation spent $90 million last year on their mission, but over $20 million of that, 23 cents of every dollar, went for the foundation's, quote, operating expenses. Now, among these were the University of Iowa's hiring of outside companies to fundraise. One example brought out by the Des Moines Register, Emergent, raised over $1 million on behalf of the university over the past 3 years. But the company essentially kept 95% of that amount donated.
Yeah.
So the university received less than $100,000 of the over $1 million donated. What can you say to a donor to the UI who has a real problem with this, who says, I thought I was giving to the University
yeah.
of Iowa, but 95% is going to this company. I have been duped.
Yeah.
Can you come to another conclusion?
Well, yes, because you really have to understand the operations and what Emergent is a little bit better than the way it was originally portrayed. And let me try to do that for you. And also
Please.
Encourage people to go to the foundation website. If you go to the foundation website, there's a Set the Record Straight right off the bat that you're going to see. And frequently asked questions with the answers to some of these questions mm-hmm. you're asking me right now in better detail than I can give in this short period of time. But let me use Emergent as a really good example of how fundraising can work. Emergent is an organization that does research on the potential for donors. So, yes, indeed, we do from time to time pay to get names, to get research and background information about potential donors. And as a result of the work that Emergent did for us, we now have over 3,000 new donors for the Holden Cancer Center and another 3,000 plus potential donors for the Children's Hospital. Now, that's not going to pay off right away.
Mm-hmm.
That's going to pay off long term once we work with these individuals and hopefully cultivate them and eventually maybe get larger gifts from them. The fact that in the first year of this contract, we actually were able to realize about $1 million in gifts is very positive because it says that this is probably a rich and interesting donor base to continue to pursue. So it's a long-term process.
So you're saying in setting the record straight, you're saying we are looking too short-term. We have to see these numbers and the numbers that they are the thin end of the wedge as
correct,
far as
correct.
What this company can
yeah.
do for us. And so when we say 95% of it the company keeps, you don't have a problem with that?
No, because it's simply not true. We pay the company this much money. We contract with them. We pay them this much money for a result. And in this case, the result is over 6,000 new donors. From those 6,000 new donors, the initial return is about $1 million in gifts. It's your operating overhead. It's okay. the cost of doing business. And I also would like to set straight the idea that it costs 23 cents on the dollar to raise a dollar, because really, if you do the calculations, and if you go to that website, you'll get a better idea of how this works as well. If you do the real calculations of what it costs to raise a dollar at the UI Foundation, you'll find out that the real number is 12 cents on the dollar.
Okay.
We actually do it very efficiently. We do it, I think, with great care and also with great skill in a very true Iowa fashion.
We have just a few minutes left in our conversation with the University of Iowa President Sally Mason. One other thing I wanted to mention, in recent days, the University of Iowa Athletic Department has approved a four-year marketing agreement with Anheuser-Busch, the beer giant. The deal allows, as I understand it, logos for Anheuser-Busch beer products and the Iowa's Tiger Hawk logo to share space. But whenever they do, the item they sit upon must also carry the message, responsibility matters. Can you tell us how much that marketing deal is worth to the University of Iowa?
Oh, I didn't bring the exact figure with me, but it's certainly several million dollars for the athletic department. It's an agreement that's been in place for actually many years.
And it's something that you directly approve?
I do directly approve it. This was the first time I was in the loop to approve it because it had been in place before I got here. Mm-hmm. So the only new piece in this arrangement is an additional $50,000 a year that will come to the university that we can use for our alcohol harm reduction program, which we're very enthusiastic about. We've had some success in terms of addressing responsible drinking. You know, for us, it all comes down to safe, legal, responsible. And we've been working on that since I arrived 5 years ago. It's a long-term project. It's not something that is going to be cured in a minute. It's something that every university faces and deals with. And it was something that was, quite frankly, a bit out of control at Iowa when I first arrived. And we're just now starting to see some positive effects from many of the alcohol harm reduction programs that we put in place.
That being said, critics say that this deal conflicts with the university's campaign for responsible consumption of alcohol, especially since the University of Iowa has, as you mentioned, during your term, especially trying to play down the party school image. Aren't you worried that the University of Iowa is not sending a consistent message that when the UI associates itself with a product in this way, that it is, in fact, indirectly endorsing it?
I think we've been very consistent in our message, which is safe, legal, responsible. And I think Anheuser-Busch's message through this entire campaign has been similar. We don't allow any of this advertising to be in our arenas or the stadium or on campus. So I really don't have the kind of problem with this that that you just mentioned.
Let me make an example, a parallel that you may find works or not. What if, for instance, Lucky Strike or Marlboro cigarettes sought a marketing agreement with the UI, a perfectly legal product with clear health implications, linked to death like alcohol? Would the UI consider that as well?
Obviously, we'd look at it, but that one I would certainly be much less in favor of. We have a smoking ban on campus.
Okay, very good. Tell us, you're leaving for Asia in a few days. What are the highlights you're personally looking forward to?
For me, I think the highlight is going to be our last night in Beijing, where I have a chance to have dinner with the International Writing Program alumni that happen to be in China. And I believe Chris Merrill, the director of the International Writing Program, will be with us. It's exciting to be able to reconnect with these individuals who have spent time in Iowa City. They're always anxious to hear what's going on in Iowa City and to share with them some really good news about a gift that we just learned about this week. This gift is it's an anonymous donor, and it's in honor of Hualing Engel, Paul Engel's widow. She, of course, is Chinese by birth and has always been a big proponent of bringing Chinese writers over as part of the International Writing Program. And my guess is she's going to want to use this gift to support writers from China to come to Iowa City.
We'll end that conversation with that wonderful news.
Thank you.
Sally Mason, president of the University of Iowa, thank you for joining us today. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks, Ben.
Coming up in just a moment, when we return after a short break, we'll talk about a new collaboration between the Iowa State Bar Association and Iowa law programs encouraging young attorneys to practice in small towns. That's when we return. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. So glad to have you with us on this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News over the noon hour. Well, we all have the need for legal services from time to time. Some of us occasionally, some of us more regularly, perhaps to draft a contract, buy or sell a house, or some work on a will, perhaps to probate a will. Rural and small town residents in Iowa are quickly losing access to legal services. as aging attorneys retire and close their small practices. And it's a void that isn't being filled by younger lawyers. This half hour, we want to talk about a new collaboration between the Iowa State Bar Association and Iowa law programs to encourage young attorneys to practice in small towns. Joining us, Phil Garland, attorney in Garner. That's a small town in the north central part of the state near Clear Lake. He is chair of the Iowa State Bar Association's Rural Practice Committee. Phil, welcome to our program.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Also joining us by phone, Kelsey Hollingshead. She is a third-year law student at the University of Iowa, originally from Eagle Grove. Now, I understand, working at a law office in Britt for the summer. Hi, Kelsey.
Hi there.
So let's start with you, please, Phil. I briefly outlined the problem in my introduction. Give us, please, some more details on the magnitude of this serious lack of attorneys in rural areas and its impact.
Well, we've seen quite a decline in a lot of counties, a lot of the smaller counties, and, of course, a lot of the counties that I wouldn't call necessarily small, Pocahontas, for instance, where there's been a pretty good decline in the population there, and there's been a similar and even greater decline in the number of lawyers practicing there. The real problem, and I don't quite have this dynamic, but I know it's there, is the lawyers now that are still practicing in those areas are older, like myself, and really have no succession plan and have not really attempted to hire anybody. Part of that reason for that is some lawyers have hired and had the associates not really like the small town, like the lawyer, get married, whatever garden variety of reasons that we're familiar with, and then they leave, and the lawyers invested a lot of time and money in training this person and then have some leave. So I think a lot of my generation has just said it's not worth high risk, very little reward, and it's been real difficult to get to lawyers to come to small communities, even when the lawyer's just saying, here, just take over my building. Here's an established practice, and they just can't get anybody to come in.
Can you name a town of a sizable population that has few or no attorneys anymore?
Well, off the top of my head, a town like Fonda that used to, I think, have a couple lawyers down there, and that's a town of about 1,000, but that town's really kind of dwindled up. I don't know how much the population is there. But I look at counties like Adams County, I think, only has two lawyers. They're both older. I won't call them elderly, but they're both older. A lot of the southwestern tiers of counties just have two or three or four lawyers practicing. Up here near me, and Manly doesn't have a lawyer, for instance, but Northwood, which is a county seat town, really only has a couple of practicing attorneys. One's a magistrate, and one's a county attorney, and that's a county of about 8,500, and a pretty prosperous county. And those are just a couple of examples. Cascade doesn't have a resident attorney. It's a town of about 2,300, but they have somebody that comes in one day a week. Emmitsburg, I assume that population is around 4,500. They have an attorney that's probably 60-ish, and that's the only attorney in town, and they have at least one law firm that sends somebody over there a couple days a week. So those are just some off the top of my head.
Okay, let's address this new program that is a collaboration that is to encourage young attorneys to practice in small towns. And I understand, Kelsey, this new program can be traced back to an invitation you sent to Phil to speak at the University of Iowa Law School. Tell us what happened at that discussion.
Well, basically, we got together and talked about what some of the benefits were to working in small towns, why we needed small towns, and really just how to move forward with the program at that discussion at the Iowa Law School. There were probably about 15 students who came who were interested in learning more about it.
Okay. So tell us, what is the program now being initiated? What's happening?
Well, I think Phil probably knows this better, but there's 8 of us placed, I think, this year in small communities around Iowa.
You're in Britt?
Yes, I'm in Britt.
Mm-hmm. And have you been specifically trained for legal services in these rural areas, the small town areas? Is that a different kettle of fish, Phil, from being in a larger urban area?
Well, I think there's less specialization in a small town, and we sort of get to be the jack of all trades in a large fashion, and do a little bit about a lot of things, and perhaps not so much a lot about a few things. And so we have less specialization. I think the trick is just to get the students here, and what I try to sell the product is that I deal with people problems, not corporate problems.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's what we try to encourage them to do. A lot of this is succession planning, where, as I talked about earlier, I can have a law student come in for a couple of years and not only train them, but to get to know them, and then I don't have the big investment that I would in a person who has graduated, had been graduated from law school and passed the bar. My costs will be minimal, but we're also expanding it to really try and encourage a lot of us in small-town Iowa to hire a law clerk in the summertime to you know, come in and help us be an extra set of hands and to really take a spin and see what life is like in a small town, even if we don't have an intention of hiring in the future.
Kelsey, what is the appeal for you in working in a small town?
Well, I grew up in a small town, so I'm familiar with it. I really like the strong sense of community in a small town. I think, like Phil mentioned, you get to work with people more, and that's what I like. I'm more interested in working with the elderly population, which is a big part of the population in rural Iowa. So those are the few reasons.
Mm-hmm. Phil Metz said, I think you said, Phil, high risk and no reward is one of the motivating factors moving attorneys or not pulling in a new generation of attorneys to small towns and rural areas. How do you address that particular thing? That seems to be the biggest problem, isn't it, Phil?
Well, it really is when you hire a new person. So if a lawyer has somebody clerk for them, or summer intern, however you want to refer to it, and if they would work a year or two, and you know there's a good marriage there between the attorney and the clerk, then the investment is very small, and at least you hopefully have gotten over the hurdle of the person. I mean, they know each other. The student knows the town, knows what the town has to offer. We think there's a great better chance of the attorney staying there. There's always risk. And, you know, what we're trying to figure out is how we can get a married couple to come to a small community. So if I have a single person like Kelsey and they marry somebody from Des Moines, they're going to probably move. So there's some issues there, but that happens with attorneys after they've graduated too. They come to the small community. Now you're paying a pretty good salary to somebody. You're putting on an extra secretary and you know, other expenses that go along that with that benefits. And then after, like I say, a year or two, they decide the bright lights of Des Moines or Iowa City is more appealing. You lose them.
Mm-hmm.
The other key thing that I think is very important is that these students have lots of debt, and to some sense, even a massive amount of debt. So if I have a student that works for me as a clerk for a year or two, they're going to be road ready when they pass the bar exam, and they're not going to need to know the way to the courthouse. They're going to know that. They're going to have sat in and countless meetings with me. They're going to have done drafting of pleadings, petitions. I've had my clerk this summer that has just done just about everything that I do, and a lot of hands-on time, so that in 2 years there's going to be very minimal training available. So it's not going to be like I'm hiring somebody that I don't know anything about. It's somebody that I know a lot about and would hopefully pay them more to tackle the big burden of debt. One of the things that hurts a small town lawyer or somebody coming to a small town is the pay, and when they have student loans of $100,000 or so, that's a lot of debt.
Right. So it's not only the bright lights of Des Moines, but the bigger bucks to pay off those debts. Does this program cost anything? I understand that also Drake University, Creighton University are participating as well. Is there any cost here?
No. And what we're trying to do, besides the people that we've directly placed in our judicial district that Kelsey and I are in, is the 2A district. We have, I think, 8 students here in this area. Not all of them came through our program, but we plan to get together this summer and kind of hash out just what we do. It doesn't cost the universities anything. It doesn't cost the students anything. And you know, it's just a lot of time on behalf of members of our committee that are trying to accomplish this. But we're going to try and figure out just what the students have done for each particular lawyer during the summertime, if we build out part of their time, and what the actual cost to us would be during the summertime. I think my secretary or not my secretary, but the clerk I have, will cost a pretty small amount of money. I would say less than a couple thousand dollars for the whole summer.
So it sounds like this may be also because you're initiating this. This is the first time that these law students have gone out in this program, that you're expecting to learn something. This is experimental to some degree.
It's very experimental. We got a very late start. We met January 28th, and thanks to Kelsey and her idea and getting the students together. She did a great job of getting students together. There was a lot of interest at the University of Iowa. Most of them wanted to stay in the Iowa City area, which was very, very difficult, and we had employers that I know contacted students there, and most of them had jobs. So they start looking for work about the 1st of December, here we were 2 months later trying to entice people, and by the time I get the lawyers off the dime, most of the students had been hired or were pretty well set on employment. So we've got a real late start. We're hoping next year to be a little bit better geared up, and we'll start. We're thinking maybe right after the first semester is over, before they start back in January, so we'll be a little bit further ahead of where we'll be way ahead of where we were this year.
Phil Garland is with us, if you just joined us. Phil Garland is an attorney in Garner. That's a small town in the north central part of the state. He's chair of the Iowa State Bar Association's Rural Practice Committee. Our other guest joining us by phone, Kelsey Hollingshead, a third-year law student at the University of Iowa, originally from Eagle Grove, participating in this new program by working at a law office in Britt this summer. The problem? Rural and small-town residents are quickly losing access to legal services as aging attorneys retire, close their small practices, and it's a void that's not naturally being filled by younger lawyers. So this is a program that is putting half a dozen or a dozen, how many exactly, Phil, out in the summertime to these rural communities in need, right?
Right, and as Kelsey has indicated, we're aware of 8 that came through our program. I'm aware of another 4 in our judicial district here, which is about 225 lawyers. So we've got another 4 who are basically local law students that in their hometown are working for lawyers. A couple of those are succession plans where they hope to go to work for that lawyer upon graduation or small firm. So, that's sort of what we're trying to do is to there's no question in my mind I never intended to hire an associate just because of the high risk, no reward. I'm pretty sure now that I'm going to stick with this program for a couple of years and hopefully find a fit and have somebody that will be working for me in 2 or 3 years.
Mm-hmm. Now, I wonder if this downturn in the number of rural attorneys has also something to do with our digital age, because there are, in the meantime, many online services that deal with law, such as LegalZoom. What part do you think they play in this problem? Or perhaps a solution to it as well?
I really don't think our problem is with LegalZoom in small-town Iowa, and I may be mistaken on that. There's probably some of that, because I think there's more of a tendency in a small-town person not to be quite sophisticated to use that type of material. I think in probably 10 years with the younger generation or 20 years, I think you'll probably see a little bit more than that. But, my clientele over 35 or 40, I would be surprised if many of them visit websites and do much online work of that nature whatsoever. So I'm sure we face some of that, but I don't think that's as dynamic here as it is in the larger cities.
So what are people in small towns doing when they lose their attorney? When their legal services disappear from town, they have to plan better and drive somewhere.
They have to plan better, and it's sort of the Walmart attitude that, they're used to going to Mason City to shop. We're 25 miles from Mason City, so, they already have that somewhat in their psychic anyway, so they're able to just go ahead and go down the road for where they already are shopping. So it's not that big a deal that it might have been 30 or 40 years ago.
Now, I'm sure that the lack of attorneys is not a new problem, and there are more rural areas in the country than in our state, in Iowa. For instance, we could imagine parts of Wyoming and Montana having a real dearth of legal services. Do you know what rural communities in other parts of the country are doing to face their problem? We assume they have one, or even a more drastic one.
I know there are a lot of, because of this, and then this program is, the Rural Practice Committee has been around for a couple of years, and I've looked into other programs in other states. South Dakota has been pretty aggressive, University of South Dakota, in placing their law students in rural areas. But they have problems, especially in the smaller places. Nebraska has 21 counties where they have two or less attorneys. One of the great stories, Kimball County, Nebraska, and town of Kimball, which is about 2,500. The judge that is the head judge out in Scotts Bluff said that he approved $250,000 worth of court-appointed fees in last year for Kimball County, Nebraska, and there's no attorneys in Kimball County taking court-appointed fees. There's only two lawyers in a town or a county of 8,000, and they drive from Scotts Bluffs or Gearing, which are 37 and 40 miles, so 45 miles away. So there's a lot of legal work out there that people are just, in the state, spending a lot of money to have people drive to take care of that legal business. And so Nebraska I'm a little bit more familiar with and South Dakota, but it's a problem in all areas, especially in small towns, and getting lawyers to do a lot of the work, especially, like I say, on this contract, court-appointed work, because every criminal with an indictable offense is entitled to a lawyer, so mm-hmm. the lawyer has to go to that community.
So we're talking, just to be clear, we're talking about private legal services, not government services such as the county attorney.
Correct.
Okay. Now, it seems, as you describe this, a parallel problem is had by the medical profession with doctors and nurses in rural areas. Can we learn there?
Well, we've watched that a little bit, but unfortunately, you know, one of the things that the doctors and the nurses in the medical field, there's the need is there, but a lot of times when they're placed out here, they get some government help as far as debt forgiveness and loan forgiveness or setting up offices, and unfortunately, our profession, nobody cares too much about lawyers, so... So we haven't been able to get any type of help. We've got some loan forgiveness, but most of that loan forgiveness that is available is either for government-type employees or for legal services, Iowa Legal Aid, for instance. We don't really, the common person who is carrying this $100,000 or more of debt that I'm talking about really doesn't get any help on that at all, and that would be great. Debt and medical expenses... I tell everybody I left Omaha, Nebraska to come to Mason City, Iowa, and took about a 2/3 pay cut. And would I have done that if I had to pay $800 a month for medical insurance? I only had to pay $125. I know it was a different time, but it was $125 a month for even pregnancy coverage back then. So those two things are big dynamics that we have that, generally speaking, the medical profession, pharmacists, dentists, and doctors don't face as much as we do.
Mm-hmm. Kelsey Hollingshead, don't you worry about the debt issue when you think about perhaps staying long-term in a small town?
Yeah, I do. To be honest, I haven't really prepared for that yet. The one thing about the small town is the cost of living generally is a little bit less than you're going to find in Chicago or Des Moines, so that does become a factor. But other than that, I haven't really planned for that.
Okay, so that's a potential problem on the horizon.
Correct.
Okay. Do you have an average number of, when you talk with your fellow law students, what would be a good range of the indebtedness when you are leaving school? How many thousand?
Just talking law school, it's generally over 100,000 easy.
Wow.
And then depending on undergrad, you know, if you went to a private school or public school, that would make a big difference. I mean, you can talk anywhere from 150,000 up.
Mm-hmm. I wonder if the 2008 recession, how that specifically affected Iowa lawyers, rural Iowa lawyers. We have just a couple minutes left. Phil, could you speak to that?
Well, I think it was a dramatic impact on some of the ideas of talent or hiring in small towns, just like it was in big towns. Frankly, it would be my opinion. We had five firms that were going to hire law students that had sort of signed on to hire law students this summer in small town Iowa, but have ended up hiring lawyers because their business just increased enough that they've been looking and have hired lawyers. So I think we've seen a pretty good uptick in Iowa and small town Iowa in some places and some firms to hire lawyers. So I don't think there's any question that back from 2008, maybe even through maybe mid 2011. That there was just a kind of a drag on all law firms, and were we any worse or any better than Des Moines? We were probably, or the big cities, I think we were maybe the same, but it seems to me like we've got a little bit more movement out here, and maybe it's just because I see it here and I'm not in Des Moines and Cedar Rapids and just don't see what they're doing, but I know, like I say, we had five firms that have hired lawyers and not students, so good for the lawyers, not good for our student program, but we're still happy to have the talent in legal small-town Iowa.
Kelsey, just a few seconds to answer the question. How do you sense the job market is for graduating attorneys?
In general?
Yes. What are you hearing from your classmates?
Well, I know it's difficult, especially if you're trying to look for Chicago. It's very competitive in law school, obviously, and with the decrease in jobs, the competitiveness is even higher, so...
It's tough going at times, depending on where you're looking.
Sure.
We wish you all the best of luck. Thank you for sharing this program. Phil, any contact information for people who want to find out more about it?
They could contact me at 641-923-3792, or my email address is garlandlawfirm@gmail.com.
Phil Garland, thank you for joining us, along with Kelsey Hollingshead. We wish you all the best in the legal world there.
Thank you so much.
Okay. River to River is produced by Alex Hoyer and Catherine Perkins. Production assistance today from Lindsay Moon. It's her last day after many years of tremendous work for Iowa Public Radio. We wish you all the best, Lindsay. We will miss you so much. Technical support from Dennis Reese, the executive producer of Iowa Public Radio's talk shows, is Jeff Schmidt. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us. Thank you.